me join in welcoming everyone that is among us today, especially those of you that are visiting. We are glad to have you here, and we hope that you'll be able to come back and worship with us whenever you have the opportunity to do so. We want you to know that you're always welcome among us. We just sung a great song about heaven. When we all get to heaven, what a day of rejoicing that will be. And I'd like for us to think in a direction this morning that hopefully will lead us to that thought again and see perhaps an aspect of what is so great about that existence. But we're going to start in the passage that was just read in our hearing, Joshua chapter 8 and verse 31. We are told there that Joshua built an altar on the top of Mount Ebal, and he did so in accordance with the commandment that the Lord had given to Israel. That commandment is written back in Deuteronomy chapter 27. In verse 4, God said, "When you cross the Jordan, you shall set up on Mount Ebal these stones. As I am commanding you today, you shall coat them with lime. You shall build there an altar to the Lord your God, an altar of stones. You shall not wield an iron tool on them." As far as I know, that is the first time in the Bible that God had ever given such a direction to anyone. Make an altar, but don't cut the stones. Don't use any tools on any of the stones that you use to make this altar. And I want to suggest to you there that God was setting a precedent. And this idea that man was not to touch it with a tool turns out, I think, to be actually pretty significant, as I hope that we will learn together this morning as we look at the Word of God. Now, this altar certainly was assembled by man. God said, "Take stones and make an altar." But as we have noted, it was unique in that God said, "Do not cut any of the stones, use no tools upon it." In other words, God was saying, "I want you to use only the materials that I made, not the ones that are the work of your hands. You will use the stones that are part of the created order and build an altar from them." And in this way, therefore, the altar that Joshua builds on Mount Ebal is, even though an altar assembled by man, it was not designed by man. And the context here, I think, is rather significant as well. This is after the Israelites have entered the promised land. This is the first recorded altar that they have built in the land of Canaan after crossing the Jordan. They have defeated the Canaanites at the city of Jericho. They have overcome the problem at Ai and Achan's sin that occurred there. And now Joshua assembles this altar on Mount Ebal, and we are told there in Joshua chapter 8 that they offered sacrifices upon it to the Lord. And it seems to me that that is significant in at least two ways. First of all, it is a rededication on the people's part to God after the sin of Achan. Remember that Achan had disobeyed God in stealing something from Jericho. Jericho was the first fruits of Canaan, as it were. The first conquered city that was an indication to them that they would conquer all the cities of Canaan. And as the first of anything, it belonged to God, and so it was to be burned with fire and given completely to God. But Achan had stolen something from Jericho, and in the process had stolen something from God. And you'll remember that God said, "I want all the nation to stone him with stones. I want everybody to participate in the repudiation of this man's deed, to show to me that you do not approve of it." And that's exactly what they did. And as a continuance of that idea, they came here to Mount Ebal, and they built this altar, as God had told them to do, to show continuously that they were indeed dedicated to God, that they were not going to be a people like Achan. But it seems significant in another sense as well, and that is that this is the first altar that they build in the land, and they offer sacrifices to God there in kind of a way of saying that, "God, we have come into this land as your people. We have come into this land with a sense of dedication to you. And we understand that we are here by your grace. And they offered this offering to God, and they built this special kind of altar there as a way of consecrating themselves as the people of God. I want you to keep in mind that idea that God had told them, don't use any iron tools against it. Because as we go through the Bible, we actually find that idea expounded upon in many ways. And there is a particular phrase in the Bible that occurs maybe about a dozen times or so that we want to concentrate on this morning, and that is the phrase, made with hands. Over and over again, we're going to see in the Bible this phrase about things that are made with hands. And in particular, that phrase always has a negative connotation to it in the Bible. Things made with hands do not belong in the service of God. Now, why is that? What's wrong with things that are made with human hands? Well, the fact is that they are by their nature imperfect. And there might be some people today that would argue with me about that. People might say, well, you know, we can make synthetic oil that's better than the oil we pump out of the ground. We can make oil where every molecule of that oil is exactly like every other molecule, and it is more perfect than what we get out of nature. Well, that's a judgment, I suppose, perfect in some sense, imperfect perhaps in another sense. But beyond that kind of debate, what makes man-made things, what makes things that are made with hands unacceptable is the fact that when man makes things, he makes them according to his own mind. They become a reflection of man himself. The things that man makes become a reflection of man's desires, man's ways, and man's will. And therein, I think, lies first and foremost the significance of what God told Joshua there in Joshua chapter 8. That you're going to build an altar to me, but you're going to use my material, not yours. It's going to be built by stones that I made, not that you made. Because I do not want this altar to be a reflection of what you think and what you have done and what you have willed and what you think is good. It's to be built the way that I want it, God said. And it is interesting that this phrase, made with hands, is used most frequently in the Bible in connection with worship. This phrase, or this word in the ancient language, is used mostly of temples, but also of idols. Go, if you will, to Leviticus chapter 26. And I want you to notice the way God speaks to his people there concerning their behavior as they were about to go into the land of Israel. In Leviticus 26 and verse 1, you shall not make for yourselves idols, nor shall you set up for yourselves an image or a sacred pillar, nor shall you place a figured stone in your land to bow down to it, for I am the Lord your God. And then look in verse 30. I will destroy your high places, cut down your incense altars, and heap your remains on the remains of your idols, for my soul shall abhor you. Now in the original, the word translated idols there literally means the thing that you make with your hands. And God said, here's what I don't want. I don't want you coming into the land and making your own religion. Making for yourself a god, carving an image, carving a stone, carving a pole, making something with your hands that reflects what you want, what you like, what you think ought to be done, and what you want. And if you do that, God said, I'll destroy you and them, because that's not what we're here for. Go, if you will, to Isaiah chapter 17 and verse 8. As Isaiah looked around at the people of his day, by the Spirit of God, he said in Isaiah 17 and verse 8 that he will not have regard for the altars, the work of his hands, nor will he look to that which his fingers have made, even the Asherim and incense stands. And you'll notice the context in verse 7 that he is there speaking about the Messianic age. In that day, man will have regard for his Maker. His eyes will look to the Holy One of Israel, and he will not look to the altars, the work of his own hands. And there is a great contrast that Isaiah sets up there between what God wanted, what God planned for his people that would come to fruition in the Messianic age, and what God had in Israel. Because they had made altars with their own hands, and they were trusting in them because they were a reflection of themselves. And God said, but in the Messianic age, I'm not going to have a people like that. I'm not going to have a people that looks to themselves for their own salvation. In that day, they will have regard for their Maker. They will look to me, God said. Turn back, if you will, in Isaiah to chapter 2 and in verse 18. And notice what Isaiah says back there in the opening words of his prophecy. Chapter 2, look at starting in verse 17. The pride of man will be humbled, the loftiness of men will be abased, and the Lord alone will be exalted in that day. But the idols, again, the things made with hands, will completely vanish. And then in chapter 10 and verse 11, we find that same expression. Shall I not do to Jerusalem and her images just as I have done to Samaria and her idols? And again, the word there refers to that which is made with hands. You see, the problem is that what man makes becomes his idol. And that's not true just of these people back in ancient times. We find the same kind of sentiment expressed in the book of Acts. As Paul was preaching in Acts chapter 19 and in verse 26, remember that Paul had been in the city of Ephesus and he had been preaching the gospel. And we hear a little bit of what Paul had said as these pagans are now concerned over the progress of the gospel. In Acts 19, 26, you see and hear that not only in Ephesus, but in almost all of Asia, this Paul has persuaded and turned away a considerable number of people, saying that gods made with hands are no gods at all. That's exactly what God had said in the Old Testament through Isaiah and in Leviticus and other places, that that's not a god. And Paul had been saying that to the Ephesians and to the people of Asia Minor as far as he went, that gods made with hands aren't really gods. They're idols. The fact is that man has a tendency to self-worship. And that's what idolatry really is at its heart and soul. Idolatry is the worship of self. Because what man does is he makes an image or he creates something that can substitute for an image, something that reflects his own desires, something that reflects his own selfishness, something that he thinks if he pays attention to it, that it will repay him and make him rich or make him happy. And he gives his time and his energy and his thoughts and his resources to that. And in effect, he worships it because it's what he wants. It reflects his own desires. That's what idolatry is. It is the worship of something that we have made to express our own desires. The worship of something that really reflects our own will. And again, we can understand, therefore, why God said to Joshua to build the altar on Mount Ebal with stones that you did not cut. God was saying that this worship that you give to me and the way you start your life in this new land is not going to be a reflection of you. It's going to be a reflection of what I want. And you think also, not only the altar on Mount Ebal, but the tabernacle as well, going back perhaps even further than that. You remember that passage in the book of Exodus where God said to Moses that, see that you make it according to the pattern which I showed you on the mount. That the tabernacle was God's design, not man's. And yet man still had a part in building it. Man assembled it, but the design of it was God's. And God was trying to say to them that my worship and my service and what you give to me must be a reflection of who I am and not what you want. It must be a reflection of my will and not yours. And let us pause, if we will, for just a moment and think about an application. We've suggested that this phrase, made with hands, as it is used in the Bible, suggests idolatry. And I wonder, brethren, I just wonder if that still isn't true today. Do we still worship the things that we make? I would be surprised if we didn't. I would be surprised if we're fundamentally any different from the ancient Israelites or from the ancient pagans in Asia Minor. Because, as we suggested, there is something in us that wants to make something of our own. Make something that reflects us and give our attention to it and pour out our resources to it, thinking that it will repay us for our will. Do we still worship what we make? How about our houses, the houses that we have built? Are we in love with them? How about the lifestyles that we have made for ourselves? The hard work that we have poured into the jobs and careers that we have created for ourselves? Do we really believe in our hearts that those are the things that are going to make us happy? Do we pour our time and energy into those things like an ancient man would to an idol, believing that if we just pay enough attention to those things, that happiness and success and prosperity and pleasure and all of those things will be ours? Do we worship what we have made for ourselves? How about our own self-understanding? My own sense of who I am and maybe how important I am and what I've attained. Do we worship that in the back of our minds? Do we feed that and do we give our resources to it? Do we bolster it up? Do we give that our attention, thinking that if I can just convince myself of who I am and who I think I am, that I'll be okay and I'll be fine and I'll be perhaps even better than other people? Do we worship what we have made for ourselves? I want to suggest to you this morning that that is exactly what is wrong with human religion. And that is true first and foremost of Judaism, because there was a sense in which the things of Judaism were made with human hands. The altar that Joshua built on Ebal, even though had no iron tool against it, it was assembled by men. The tabernacle, even though it was built according to God's design, it was still built by men, and therein lie its problem. That it was, at the end of the day, still something that man had a hand in creating. And for that reason, it could never be the perfect way to approach God. You remember what Stephen said about it in Acts chapter 7, don't you? As he was preaching to them, and he said an amazing thing that amazes me every time I read it. In Acts chapter 7 and verse 48, the Most High does not dwell in houses made with human hands. And I know you've considered the context in which he said that. In Acts chapter 7 and verse 41, our fathers made a calf and brought a sacrifice to the idol, and they were rejoicing in the works of their hands. But God turned away and delivered them up to serve the host of heaven. You also took, verse 43, the tabernacle of Molech, the star of the god Rompha, the images which you made to worship. God said, I will remove you to Babylon. When we look back at those ancient Israelites and their idolatry and the things that they had made with their hands, and then Stephen says in verse 44, and our fathers also had the tabernacle of testimony. Something they had made with their hands. Oh, yes, at God's will, at God's pattern, but they had made it according or with their own hands. And Stephen, as he stood with that marvelous temple made with human hands as his backdrop, said that God does not dwell in houses made with human hands. And the implication was clear, that Stephen was saying that this temple that you have built is simply the last in a long line of idols that the Israelites have created for themselves. And they treated the tabernacle in that very way, and the Jews of Stephen's day certainly treated the temple in that very way. Something to look at to be proud of. Something to look at and say, look what we did. And this is where our safety lies, and this is where our trust is. And the temple is going to be safe, like they said in Jeremiah's day. They didn't believe that the Romans were going to come and destroy them. They thought that because they had built the temple of God, that everything was going to be okay. And they didn't see that nothing man-made can be trusted. Paul says in Ephesians chapter 2 and verse 11 that concerning the circumcision that is part of the law, the old law of Moses, that it is of the same nature. Ephesians 2 and verse 11, remember that formerly you, the Gentiles in the flesh, were called uncircumcision by the so-called circumcision, which is performed in the flesh by human hands. And the nuance of Paul's statement there is clear. He's saying that, yes, it was a distinction between Jews and Gentiles, but it was a fleshly distinction. It was a distinction based on something made and done with human hands. It was fleshly. And what is made with fleshly hands is itself fleshly. And this thing that the Jews had done with their own hands, performing this rite of circumcision on their children, was something that they did. And just like the building of the temple and just like the building of the tabernacle, they worshiped that as if it were a god. They put their trust in that. They said, we are the ones who are keeping the covenant of circumcision. We're the ones who are right with God because we have done this right, and therefore we don't have to worry about being with God. And Paul says later on in Galatians chapter, or previously in Galatians chapter 6 and in verse 13, that those who are circumcised do not even keep the law, but they desire to have you circumcised so that they may boast in your flesh. That's what it become a matter of boasting. That this is the kind of thing that we can be proud of, the thing that we do with our own hands. And they didn't see that even though it was a God-ordained rite, just like God had ordained building the tabernacle and the temple, that it could only be imperfect to the extent that it involved human hands. But not only the Jews, but also the Gentiles. In Acts chapter 17, Paul is preaching to the people of the city of Athens. And if you know anything about the ancient city of Athens, even to this day, you can go to the city of Athens, and therein lies one of the greatest temples of the ancient world, the Parthenon. One of the most beautiful architectural examples of all of antiquity. And Paul, in that setting of that famous Greek temple, said in Acts 17:24, that the God who made the world and all things in it, since he is Lord of heaven and earth, does not dwell in temples made with hands. The Gentiles had made the very same mistake that the Jews had made. That you've got gods of your own creation, temples that you have built with your hands. This is only a monument to yourself and not to the God of heaven. And Paul said, I want to tell you about the God that you have missed, the God you haven't honored, the one that has kept you alive and given you everything, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And perhaps at this point we can pause again for another thought about application. We look at the Jews, and we see their pride in their humanly built temple and in what they did in the rite of circumcision with their own hands. And we look at the pagans having built these marvelous Greek temples and proud of their beauty having been made with hands. And brethren, we need to avoid the same kind of thinking. And I'm about to say something here that'll probably get me in trouble, but I'm going to say it anyway. What do we think about our facilities of worship? You know, one of the things that I like so much about this congregation is that we've got one of the plainest little old church buildings I've ever seen. Are we a church because we have property and because we have a building? Or are we a church because we have been baptized in the name of Jesus Christ? You know, sometimes we get to thinking, oh, if we lost our building, we wouldn't be a church anymore. Nonsense. Or sometimes I've even heard people say that well, we were just meeting and then we got our building and started to worship as a church. Well, what were you doing before then? What were you before? Were you not a church until you got a building? God forbid we should treat church buildings as status symbols. To think that we're a better church than some other place because we have a building, or a bigger building, or a more expensive building. And I'm not accusing anybody of anything. I'm sounding a warning. Because if that's our mentality toward property and facilities, then we are idolaters just as much as the Jews had become and the pagans were. Our religion does not consist in what we have made. Our identity as the people of God does not depend on what we have made with our hands. And that brings us to Hebrews chapter 9, where I'd like to get to the core of our thoughts this morning. In Hebrews chapter 9, the author, of course, is speaking about what Jesus does as our great high priest. And he says in Hebrews 9 and verse 11 that Christ has appeared as a high priest of the good things to come, and he has entered through the greater and more perfect tabernacle not made with hands. That is to say, not of this creation. And in verse 24, Christ did not enter a holy place made with hands, a mere copy of the true one, but into heaven itself to appear in the presence of God for us. And I want to suggest to you, friends and brethren, that therein lies the power of Christianity, that it is not an earthly religion. That it is not based upon an approach made to God in a sanctuary made with human hands. That our approach to God is accomplished in a place that is not made with human hands. That it is accomplished in the place that God Himself has designed and made, according to His will, according to His purpose. Therein lies Christianity. Not in what we have made, not in what we can say we have done, but that we come to God through what God has made, in a sanctuary not made with hands, reflecting His will and His purpose. And that is why, even to this day, Christianity is not associated with a particular place in the world. You know, other religions have places that are the core of their religion. Places like Mecca, for example. That is the centerpiece of that religion. But Christianity isn't based in or stemming from one particular city, because our religion is not earthly. And it doesn't depend on this spot or that spot, because our approach to God is in a place made without hands. And therein lies a great difference, I hope you can see, between what the Jews were doing in Judaism, what the pagans were doing in paganism, and what we have in Christ Jesus. Before Christ came, men were making things with their hands. And the entire approach to God had become, see God, what we have made, do you like this? Does this please you? This is what we like, this is what we've come up with. And men were taking what they had made and offering it to God, and God said, no, that's not what I want. Christ has entered in to the true holy place, not made with hands, not a reflection of what we like and what we want and our own selfish desires, but to accomplish our fellowship according to God's own will. And that's why, as the author of the book of Hebrews points out so often in that book, that Jesus is now gone to be seated at the right hand of God in fulfillment of Psalm 110, because in doing so he has accomplished the perfect access to God. And while we are in this world, in this flesh and in this realm, we live in hope of joining him in that one, where the worship that we give him will not be restricted in the fleshly human ways that it is now, but that we might worship him in a way that is made only by God. Just as kind of a side note, I've often wondered if this isn't why God doesn't want us to play mechanical musical instruments in his church. Because what is that? It's the making of our own hands. To put some pieces of wood together and pull some strings across it and play it and say, God, do you like that? We made this and it sounds good to us. Do you like it? No. Ephesians 5:19. Speaking to one another in psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs, singing and making melody in your heart. Using the instrument that God made, not the one that I made. Worshiping him with something that is according to his design and his origin, not the work of my hands. And we begin to understand that this idea of human-made and man-made just doesn't cut it with God. And perhaps we can begin to really understand what our worship is to God. That it is to come from the instrument that God has created and placed within us to play for him, the human heart. The fact is that a perfect order awaits the people of God in which we will worship God in the most perfect and sincere way. You remember what Jesus said to the woman at the well? In John chapter 4 and in verse 23, she had asked Jesus, well, you seem to know something about this. Tell me, are we supposed to be worshiping in Jerusalem or over here in Samaria? Because there's a debate about that among our people. And Jesus said that God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship him in spirit and in truth. His answer was that it's not one place on the map that God is worshipped. Any place built by human hands can never be adequate. That God wants people who are going to worship him in the place that he made, in their spirits, and according to his truth, not man's idea. And while we are here in this world, we have already begun that more perfect kind of worship. Not in things that we have made with our hands, not in a place that is built with our hands, but with the instrument that God has made, in the fellowship that God has created in his church and in our hearts. A worship that is based and offered there is spiritual and not human. In Matthew chapter 15, Jesus was upbraiding the scribes and the Pharisees, and he said to them in verses 8 and 9, that this people honors me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. In vain do they worship me, teaching as doctrines the precepts of men. They had invented all these rules, all these little regulations that had the appearance of holiness. And they thought that by them they were more righteous and exceedingly acceptable to God. And Jesus said, you're not. Because the thing that God wants in worship is the heart, the thing that he gave us, the thing that he made, to worship him with that, not with the thing that we've made, not with the rules that we've made, not with the ideas that we've come up with, but with the heart that he put within us. In Philippians chapter 3, Paul makes a statement that runs in the completely opposite direction, therefore, to that Pharisaic kind of worship that Paul himself once knew quite well. Philippians 3 and verse 3, that we are the true circumcision who worship in the Spirit of God and glory in Christ Jesus and put no confidence in the flesh. Oh, the Jew was proud of what he had done with his hands, the circumcision that was according to the flesh, done with human hands. But Paul says, we are the true circumcision who put no confidence in what we've done, not in our own flesh and our own making, but we worship in the Spirit. As Jesus said, they that worship the Father must worship in spirit and in truth. In that same connection, we are told in Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 16 that those who have no ties to this world make it clear that they desire a better country, that is a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. And even though the term made with hands does not appear in that text, it is clear in the context that God has made a city unlike any city you and I have ever lived in, not a human city, not a city reflecting man's pride and man's ingenuity, but reflecting God's design and God's will. And he's made a place like that for us. And that's why Paul says in Philippians 3 and verse 20 that our citizenship is in heaven. As John describes in Revelation 21 and 22, a city in which sits the heavenly temple, where God's people will give him the absolute purest praise that is possible. Not in something done by their making, but in a place and with an instrument that is holy by God's making. And not only that, not only do we worship in spirit here, and not only has God promised to make us a heavenly city, but in that day we're going to be worshiping God in a more perfect body. And notice what Paul says in 2 Corinthians 5 and verse 1. We know that if the earthly tent, which is our house, is torn down, he's talking there about this body, this flesh and blood, that if I die, Paul says, that we have a building. Notice the contrast there between tent and building. You know what it's like to live in a tent? You ever been camping? Flimsy little structure. You wouldn't want to live in it for very long. You can't live in it for very long, but a building, something fitted and framed, oh yeah, you can live in that for a long time. And if this tent is torn down, Paul says, we have a building, a new body, a house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens. As we go to be in that city that is not made with hands, to worship God with our hearts that were not made with hands, we will be in a body that is not made with hands, a body that is not fleshly, a body that does not have its own desires, that constantly pulls us away from the will of God. We'll be in a place where those temptations have ceased, where our bodies will not be a hindrance to us because they are fashioned ever more perfectly for that place. And I find it interesting that Jesus himself talked about that. We hear indirectly a statement of Jesus that was brought up at his trial in Mark 14 and in verse 58. We heard him say, I will destroy this temple made with hands, and in 3 days I will build another made without hands. And the Jews thought that he was talking about the temple of Jerusalem. But we learn from John chapter 2 and verse 21 that he was talking about his body. That his body made with hands, his fleshly body would be destroyed, but in 3 days he would rise in a different form, as Mark tells us. In a different body meant to inhabit eternity. And that is what we are longing for. And that is what we are aiming for. And that is the goal of what we do here. To not worship and serve God according to the flesh, according to my mind, according to what I like, according to things that are the making of our own hands, but ever to be striving toward that goal of giving God what he has prepared according to his will, not made with hands, but according to the divine work. The question, therefore, this morning is, do you have a place reserved for you in that God-made realm where we will fully participate in the purest worship not made with hands, in a city not made with hands, in a body not made with hands, to give God the praise that is so wonderfully due to him forever and ever? Do you have a place reserved for you there? If not, we stand ready to help you obey the gospel this morning, if that be your desire. If you're already a child of God and there's something amiss in your life that we can pray with you for, we stand ready to help you to do that as well. Won't you come as we stand and sing this song together?